Welcome to the best damn podcast ever. My name is Blake Buck, also known as Boss Hog around these parts. Have to add to around these parts. And co-hosting with me this week is William Miller, the sexiest man ever.
How you doing, Blake Buck?
I'm doing pretty good. We've also got Justin Ficarotta of Kill Monty fame.
How's it going? Soon to be a Project Stingray fame.
That's right. That's right. Project Stingray fame. That's right. But by the way, just as an update, can you give us any more info on Stingray? When's that heat coming out?
It is coming out when it comes out, and it's going to be about whatever it's about.
Oh, well.
First rule of Project Stingray is you do not ask questions.
No questions.
All right. And this is your gaming news for October 18th, 2006. All right, so this week in the news, the final Guitar Hero 2 track list has been confirmed. Capcom to dissolve Clover Studios, EB, GameStop, the PS3 and Wii pre-orders detailed, and a report on the judge's okay for Bully against Jack Thompson. All this and more on this week's Best Damn Podcast Ever.
All right, so finally, I can talk to you about what songs I'm going to beat your ass in Guitar Hero 2.
Dude, I'm going to beat you in all this heat.
I have never played this, and I will wipe the floor with you.
All right, we've got, let's see, the full 40 default songs has been released, and an additional 24 unlockable tracks. Do we have the 24 unlockable tracks listed here? I don't think we do.
No, do you?
No.
Exclusive on BDP? Oh, damn it.
No. I don't remember them off the top of my head. So Red Octane has since confirmed the accuracy of this list, which follows, separated by difficulty level. Should I read them?
There are too many, I think.
All right. We'll put it off.
Give us the highlights.
All right. Yes, give us the highlights.
Tell you what. I'll pick the best one out of each of the sections. So for opening licks, I'd say the best one out of that is Spinal Tap. Tonight, I'm going to rock you tonight.
How does that one go? Can you sing? You should sing each of these four, William Miller, with your mouth.
Look, if I were to do that, your heads would explode. My singing is outlawed in at least 6 states.
Dude, it's like the voice of God in Dogma.
Yeah, exactly.
Blam. Although I must prefer Danzig, Mother.
William Miller, I bet, has the voice of like a Dickens chimney sweep. God rest ye merry, gentlemen, may none of you dismay.
Blake, you know how I sing. We were in that musical together. You remember that?
Oh yeah,
Godspell.
No, that was a hard time in my life. Okay, there were a lot of drugs. Oh, the drug references! I keep forgetting. All right, keep going.
All right, so Amp Warmers. We have Kansas. Carry on, my wayward son.
Carry on, my wayward son.
I think Blake will just sing them. Blake will sing. All right. Let's see, String Snappers. Let me see which is the best out of here. String Snappers.
All of these are good.
Black Sabbath, of course. War Pigs and String Snappers.
Although Alice in Chains, Them Bones is good.
That's good.
I would have preferred I Stay Away.
No, you know, you get what you get. Blake Buck, go. But War Pigs.
Get what I get. War Pigs.
What's the chorus of...
All right, that's enough. Thrash and Burn. I keep picking the encore songs. It's a toss-up here between Cherry Pie and Guns N' Roses,
dude,
Sweet Child of
Dude,
Mine.
Dude, what are you talking about? I want Butthole Surfers.
Oh, man.
And I have to be nitpicky again, but Guns N' Roses, I'm missing Paradise City.
But yeah, but Sweet Child of Mine is so much more fun to play than Paradise City. Like, when you play it, you'll know. It's really fun to play. All right.
All right.
Return of the Shred is the next level, and the
I love it.
My favorite out of that is the first one of the block, which is Primus John the Fisherman. That's the only song in the game that probably has a better bass line than a guitar line, because it's an actual master track, so you're actually like playing the bass.
What's the ratio of master tracks
to
covers?
And also the Rage Against the Machine song.
Oh yeah, Killing in the Name of.
That one's
all right. The cover is a little weird, but and of course the encore for that is Aerosmith Last Child. So. All right, Relentless Riffs. We've got the Allman Brothers, Jessica, which is really good. And, yeah, I guess that's my favorite out of that one. Furious Fretwork. I don't like the names of these. Furious Fretwork? I want, like, Nut Shriveler That's what I want.
Baby Raper.
Ball Exploders.
We've got Rush YYZ. We already knew about that one though, but
yeah, we did.
Carry Me Home by Living In is pretty good. Face Melters is the final section, and of course Freebird at the end of that one. Stop. All right, sorry. Guitar Hero 2.
Well, I'm afraid of Freebird though. I prefer, dude. It's Dick Dale Miserloo. Oh my god, that's gonna hurt me in ways that I truly desire to be hurt.
Look, like all my roommates just peeked in my room. Who? Somebody play Freebird?
It frightens me just because like the whole first half of that song is boring.
Yeah.
And it's gonna be like DDR, like when you're trying to play those 10-foot songs, you have to get a perfect third song on your set. So you play two junk songs just to hope that you get every step on the third song, just so you could fail max 300 in the first 15 seconds. That's what Freebird is gonna be.
See, but you got practice mode now, so you can just skip to the good part and just play it.
Oh man.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So. Enough. Guitar Hero 2 has been rated by the ESRB T14 and will be released on PS2 on November 7th, the Xbox version sometime next year.
Just a side note, guys.
So I'm guessing the exploding heads never made it into the game.
What, talking heads? Is that what you said?
No, the exploding heads.
Oh, exploding heads. No, I don't know. Although your request, Miserloo, did make it into Guitar Hero.
That it did.
That's going to be a tough one.
Dude, that makes me happy in my nether region.
Especially for Blake Buck, who doesn't use the up-down technique. He just uses the down technique.
Look, I do not use up-down unless it's extremely necessary. Unless it's absolutely necessary. Unless it's like a 16th note.
How the hell did
note.
You Bark at the Moon without that?
I've beaten that entire game without up down because I don't use it because it's for lame zores.
No, anyway.
All right, so Capcom on Tuesday announced plans to dissolve its wholly owned Clover Studio after a decision made at the publisher's board of directors meeting. Originally established in July 2004, the studio's lineup of critically acclaimed titles. Closed, canceled, included the quirky action game Beautiful Joe, as well as a pair of games that saw release only in the U.S., the Japanese folklore-inspired Okami, closed, and the tongue-in-cheek brawler God Hand, closed! Clover Studio employed an all-star lineup of Capcom development talent, canceled, including Atsushi Inaba, producer of Steel Battalion and Voodoo Joe, studio closed down, Shinji Mikami, the creator of Resident Evil, closed down, and Hideki Kimaya, Devil May Cry director, closed down. The developer was based in Osaka, Japan, where Capcom itself is also headquartered. Clover Studio was so named as an abbreviation of Creativity Lover. It's closed down, and because the four-leaf clover signifies happiness and creativity. Closed down. The company was set up to make innovative games that would inspire the future of gaming. Closed down.
Closed down.
I just don't get this. I just don't get it. Like, okay.
I thought we were doing good.
Wait a minute. Blake Buck, you're Capcom. All right. I'm Clover. We'll do a little role playing here. Hey, Capcom. I just made all these awesome games. What are you going to do about that? Go. Like,
get the f*** out of here.
Yeah. Like, what the hell are these people thinking? This is some of the best talent that they're ever going to have.
Well, you want to hear the answer to that? The press release, I'm going to actually read this press release, and I'm going to tell you what it means. It reads as follows. Clover Studio Limited has met the goal of developing unique and creative original home video game software. However, in view of promoting a business strategy that concentrates management resources on a selected business to enhance the efficiency of the development power of the entire Capcom group, the dissolution of Clover Studios Limited has been raised and passed at a board of directors meeting. Not making us enough money.
Yeah.
That's what all that means.
Yep.
Promoting a business strategy that concentrates management resource on a little bit of money.
you know, I don't know. Maybe I've heard rumors that some of these guys are going to just break off from Capcom and make their own studio, an independent one. So it might not be the end of the Clover sort of look and feel and all of that. But it's still really stupid that they had to do that.
Well, it might be like, what is it, the Myst guy, Cyan Studios, you know, after they released Myst 5, they're like, we're done, we're closed, everybody's fired, and then a month and a half later, oh, by the way, everybody's hired back. So, you know, I mean, you never know, they might reform or...
side note, I read an article about Myst, the Uru, or Myst Online, or whatever, is gonna be back in action in some form or another. Blake, did you hear anything about that? I forgot what service it's on.
It's on GameTap, but
yeah,
I can barely hear what you're saying.
Oh, God.
Don't talk to me. That's how this show's gonna be, dude. You guys just don't talk to me, and then I'll just make jokes and make fun of you. But don't say anything back, because I won't be able to hear it.
All right, Blake Buck, take this next article. Go.
All right, so GameStop/EB PS3 and Wii pre-orders detailed. So for those of you who are watching your emails real close this week, you'll have noticed that that reservations for both the PS3 and the Wii have gone out. Gamers who blinked may have missed the opportunity to pre-order the PlayStation 3 from EB and GameStop. The retailer announced that the details of the campaign on Monday and pulled them into effect on Tuesday. Because of the extremely limited supplies, most stores were only given 8 units for pre-sale, talking about the PS3. The retailers quickly sold out of their allotment, and the majority of the units were snatched up in just minutes. So that happened on Tuesday. Every PS3 that they had got sold in like an hour. I was at my local GameStop picking up a...
Is that like all 3,000 they had ready for the U.S. launch?
I guess so. So, I was picking up Mortal Kombat Armageddon earlier in the week. And some dude walked in right on Tuesday, and he was like, "Oh, do you guys have any PlayStation 3? And the guy was like, "We sold them all in the first hour of business today." Blickaponed. So then later on in the week, let's see. Now it looks as though retailers are, this has already happened, but it looks as though retailers are taking a similar approach to the pre-orders for the Wii. In an email notice sent out to gamers on Thursday, the stores will be pre-ordering the game console on Friday. So I don't know if they still have any. I don't know the status, if there were more. Do you guys think there were more Wiis available for pre-order, or do you think about the same?
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah, I think they're going to be more. Blake Buck, whatever happened to your EB,
I've heard
GameStop?
That not only are they sold out the pre-orders at EB and GameStop, Amazon is also completely sold out.
Wow. I also heard that eBay has started shutting down trades for or auctions on pre-orders for PS2.
Really?
Yeah. Like people were selling these things for like $1,000 or more.
Wow.
It's crazy.
So it says here, however, GameStop and EB can't absolutely guarantee a system at launch for those who do successfully get their hands on the prize receipts. Disclaimer on the website reads, "We cannot control production shipping by the manufacturer. A reservation and deposit did not necessarily guarantee a system on the available launch date." So, you know, even if you order, you may not get it. So get in line, everybody.
Let me take this opportunity to say that I f-ing hate pre-orders. I will never pre-order anything again. Well, it's like, what the hell is the point of it? Excuse me, I'm sick.
Here's why they take pre-orders. It's now, okay, here, Blake Buck's going to tell the tale of his time at GameStop, all right? Now, many of you remember that Blake Buck recently applied for a position at GameStop, a lowly minimum wage position at GameStop. So, I go into the GameStop, and, you know, I first got to do all these, you know, I got to fill out the application, turn that in, then I go in and talk with the guy who runs our GameStop here in town. And he's like, he's pretty excited, you know, all right, you need to come to the second interview, or we're going to have they were going to bring a bunch of people in and have us do, like, what is it, you know, like, associate customer kind of role play where we try and act like, you know, somebody tries to act like the customer. We try and act like the salesman and try and get them to go for the more content. And so they told us about the circle of life for video games. Are you guys ready for this?
No, but go ahead.
It starts with the reserves. This is the most important part of the circle of life. There's a new game coming out, and you want to get them to reserve the game. Why is that? Because not only does it guarantee you the money, but it also they get a number of games they receive is proportional to the number of reserves they get. So if they get a lot of reserves, then they'll get a lot more games and extra as well, because they'll see, oh, well, this area has a bigger interest than this. In this title or whatever. The second step of the circle of life is to bring back that new game and get them to trade it in for a couple of used games. And then when they get the used games, you try and get them to buy the subscription, get the discount card in the magazine. They read the magazine, see the new hotness games coming out, and what do?
They buy the new game.
No. They reserve the new game.
Oh.
Ah.
The circle is complete.
What I find interesting in this circle of life is that when reserving and pre-ordering games, nowhere in that circle of life do they guarantee the customer the f***ing game.
Well, I thought they did. Like, I remember when
Tetris DS and Metroid Prime Hunters came out, I was excited to get those. I was like, dude, Wi-Fi play, first-person shooter on the DS. I was excited. So I was like checking websites and all that stuff, and of course, I wanted to make sure I got a copy of these games when they came out. So I trot over to GameStop, and I'm like, hey, you know, can I put a pre-order so I can get this game the day it comes out? So I figured, okay, I'll put down the full money for, you know, pre-ordering both these games, about $35 a piece. Release date comes out, both games come out the same day, I go to pick them up, not there, they're sold out. What the f***?
I just like to point out
that... It's like,
that,
you have my money, I bought the game. I will never pre-order anything ever again.
So here's,
but I'll carpet bomb every GameStop for.
But
it
says here, Justin Fick, as we cannot control production and shipping issued by the manufacturer, a reservation deposit does not guarantee the recipient a system available at launch. You should have read the fine print, sir.
You should have read the fine print.
But you know what? It's not fine print. It's like, I purchased this product from you. You have my money. I am your customer. Give me my product.
I could a lot of Buzzer X in Justin Fick's little rant here.
Justin Fick, you're just not falling into the circle of life, okay? You might want to go read some more Game Informer magazine to really get you back in the mode of things.
I will roll a hand grenade made out of babies into the circle of life. I've had enough.
Okay, so it's interesting, though, to point out that the only part of the circle of life where the developer actually gets money is when a new game is sold. The developers the GameStop gets 100% of the money when a used game is sold. So
that they the guy told me when I was at the thing, they make 5 to 7 times as much money off a used game as they do a new game in profit.
Yeah.
5 to 7.
Dude, GameStop is to the gaming industry what Apple is to the Mac gaming industry. I'm trying to kill it.
No, see, they just know how to work it. They're not doing anything to kill it. They just know how to work it. They know how to get the maximum amount of cash out of the racket.
Boycott GameStop. Boycott it. Find your local hole in the wall game store.
Look, when you live in Oxford, Mississippi, your option is GameStop or Walmart. Okay, so it's not like I've got much of a choice.
Like, because GameStop buys in volume, though, they can GameStop usually marks up their product 15% to 20%. And that's generally the same for all retailers that buy in volume. But if you go to one of these discount, like, mom-and-pop stores, you're either going to find used games really cheap and new games that are more expensive. So you're going to get the developer gets the same amount of money regardless of where you get it from. It's just where you're going to pay the, you know, least amount, which is probably GameStop or Walmart.
Well, it's not a matter of supporting the developer. It's a matter of spite for GameStop.
You just hate them because you didn't get your Tetris DS.
So? Doesn't matter.
All right, I'm done with that news. I'm done.
I'm a Tetris.
Okay, so Judge OK's bully. So apparently Jack Thompson got his feathers ruffled a little bit when a judge actually played the game and said it wasn't that bad. And So he wrote a letter to the judge. Do we have the letter here?
These are my favorite part. Whenever you see Jack Thompson in the headline and then you see a bunch of quotes down in the article, it's like Christmas.
It's automatic.
There's just a whole bunch of presents ready to open up.
So he went on to accuse Take-Two lawyer Rebecca Ward of lying in the courtroom when she told Friedman, who's the judge, that a teen-rated game is an age restriction at the point of sale. And yes, the ESRB ratings are only enforced voluntarily by retail outlets. So the point she was trying to make is that teen games are like restricted. You can't buy them if you're, you know, younger than the age requirement. But that's a voluntary thing, which it shouldn't be. Shouldn't be voluntary. ESRB is doing their best to rate the games. The, you know, people that sell them should respect that. And then he went on to say, like, you know, I think the judge watched a lot of video of the game, and I don't know if he actually played a lot of it, but Jack Thompson said that, like, that's kind of like the Iraqi weapons inspectors not being able to see the weapons or whatever. I don't even know. It was really stupid, but...
Dude, I love every quote this guy
just
writes.
Just to point out, though, like, okay, so the judge watched a video of the game and made a judgment, okay? That is exactly how the ESRB works. ESRB is given a tape from the developer that's got gameplay footage in it. Mm-hmm. That's got the worst, supposedly the worst gameplay footage in it. And generally, developers are very good about this because if they have to change the rating of their game doesn't sell as well. Unless you're Rockstar, and then you get more press. But in general, they want to be as truthful about their game as possible. So they send a tape with the worst stuff on it to the ESRB. ESRB selects a number of people from a cross-section of individuals who actually work with children, like childcare professionals or parents or what have you, and they watch the tape and make a decision. So the judge is using the same techniques that the ESRB does to rate games. Just wanted to point that out. And he probably played a little bit of it too, but I don't know.
Well, I would just love to write a game and send a video in and just have the movie be like, just send him a copy of Labyrinth with David Bowie. It doesn't matter what the game's about.
Dance, magic, dance. Put my magic spell on you.
I think that's the next best damn game ever. Labyrinth, the game.
Labyrinth, the game.
from the point of view of David Bowie.
I'm so androgynous,
person.
And yet
it's first person, but you still see his hair hanging down in the view.
You use that, like, magic ball. You remember the glass ball that he would wave around on his hand? That's your tax cheater.
Oh, man. Why do
we all know so much about Labyrinth? We are lame, okay?
No, because you're awesome.
Labyrinth is like the movie for art school kids. If you don't like Labyrinth, you get beat up. It's kind of like back in the day when you didn't like New Kids on the Block and you got beat up. You remember that, Blake Buck?
Oh, I remember that.
Same here with
But my favorite quote here from Thompson is that he actually blasted the judge himself for, quote, not allowing a hearing to occur because the media there would have seen how you railroaded this entire matter at the expense of children's safety.
Yeah, like, he opens the letter with accusing the judge of causing skull fractures, like, headshots with slingshots and, like, wedgies or something. Like, he actually blames the judge personally for allowing this to happen in schools. Like, his first sentence blames the judge for making schools a dangerous place because of bully. And, you know, I think about all the movies that have been released that have similar themes to this, and while, you know, interactive violence is certainly more altering to a child than passively viewing violence, it's still, you know, it's got an M rate. What's the rating? Is it M or T?
I believe it's T.
It's T.
All right. Well, the
punchline to this is that it's actually not that bad. Like, this is probably the best played marketing poker hand I have ever seen, and I want to have all of Rockstar's children. I want to be a slut for Rockstar because of what they pulled. Like, they've just made this game, which is ostensibly about this kid beating the hell out of other kids at school. But from what I've heard, it's like you're actually, like, defending the weak from the bullies, and you're, you know, like, and like you're in this group to, you know, go and beat up this homeless guy, but you end up turning and defending the homeless guy from all these other kids, and it's like you're actually a good guy in this game, and I think that's genius. So like he's just, you know, people have just jumped on this, Jack Thompson, all these, you know, wussy groups that are, you know, banned this game, it's bad for kids, and you end up being a good guy. I think it's brilliant.
What I like about this article, I saw this article like in the middle of the week, and some occurred to me. I thought to myself, you know, I don't think Jack Thompson's going to go away. Like, I thought he was just a passing fad. But he could be here for another 10 years. I mean, he's already been here for like a year. How long will this go on?
Well, I think that'd be a good thing. It'd give us something to report on. I mean, I don't know. You could see now that, like, Rockstar is using him.
Oh yeah!
Like they took that guy and everybody like him for a ride, and it's awesome. Maybe they'll just learn from this and go away, or maybe not.
He's too funny, dude.
Jack Thompson is on the Rockstar payroll.
Okay, so we were talking about this a little bit in class the other day, but it's like in 20 years or so, when the average gamer who's like 33 years old now is you know a politician. They're going to have this generational knowledge of what a game is, and that games are not all games kids can play. Like a parent today, they think, oh, a game is a game, and you know, you buy it for your kid. Well, if a game has a teen rating, you shouldn't buy it for, you know, anybody that's not 13 years old. The same thing for movies. Like our parents know immediately what a rated R movie is, but they don't always know what an M-rated video game is. But we will know that, and I think. Given enough time, given 10 years or so, maybe even less than that, this will not be an issue at all anymore.
Well, it just makes me wonder why they never use that rating for games. Why not have a rated R game? Why not rate a game PG-13?
That seems like it would make a lot of sense. Like, even if the criteria for judging that wasn't the same, using the same, like, letters, using this exact same letters and system, you know, rating the games differently, but calling it the same thing so that people actually understand, you know, what it is.
Yeah, because, I mean, when you look at what makes a rated R movie or a rated PG-13 movie, people don't look at why that's rated PG-13 or rated R. They know broad things like, oh, it has boobs or it has, you know, violence, but all they really pay attention to is rated R, rated PG-13, rated G, and they know what that means.
Right. You know, the ESRB has problems, and the ESRB has become a very defensive organization because it gets attacked all the time. I don't think it's going to change to be like that anytime soon. And I think that it's just going to be our generation that grows up and that goes out there and then knows what this stuff is, what it means. So it'll just take a little time to change.
ESRB, change your letters. Take it from the best damn podcast ever. We're trying to help.
But I think the big point here is that, like, people should stop blaming the developers for the things that they make and start blaming parents for the things that they buy for your kids. Because you got to ask yourself, number one, why does your kid have $60 that you don't know about? And number two, why don't you know what they're spending that on? Get with it, America.
All right, guys, we're skipping ahead, and now it's time for the Jag of the Week.
Blake Bug, what is your jank of the week?
Oh, man, I've got a monster of a jank this week, guys. You guys better be holding on to your seats because I'm about to blow your butt off. All right. Amazon.com has a steal on Xbox 360. Right now on Amazon.com, if you buy an Xbox 360, you not only get free shipping and no tax, but Dead Rising or Eldritch Scrolls for Oblivion for free. Blam.
Oh, man. Now, is this for the core and cool systems?
It applies to both core and premium systems. So if you're getting a premium system like me, I got to have all that heat. I got to have Xbox 360, Dead Rising, and Oblivion. So this is going to save me almost like 20% on my new Xbox I'm getting this month. So I'm going to be picking one up. So you guys better be watching out for Blake Buck on the Xbox Live Gamer Points.
Oblivion frightens me. It does not look like easy gamer score points.
I like how you don't play it because it's not easy gamer score points.
Dude, like, you guys got no idea. I am working on some power right now, Like, if you've seen my gamer tag recently, my points have skyrocketed because I've been picking off easy games. Madden 06, Cameo, which, oh my god, someone kill me. And, you know, King Kong, what else? I'm working through Prey right now, easy points. So I'm going to be submitting some articles, some write-ups on my experiences being a gamer score whore. So expect some heat very soon.
All right, good deal.
Blake Buck, it's time for judgment.
All right, so this week, guys, I picked up Mortal Kombat... The lag is affecting my ability to speak. This week I picked up Mortal Kombat again for the PlayStation 2. And I not only got the Mortal Kombat, but I got the premium edition with a bonus DVD. Yes. Yes, I'm so fancy. So, this game is essentially, if you got, I don't, William Miller, Joseph Vicker, are you guys familiar with the sort of new Mortal Kombat games that have been coming out on this current gen?
No, fill us in.
Not really.
Well, it started with Deadly Alliance. They kind of revitalized the series, brought back some of the old, I think Deadly Alliance probably had, I think it had around 8, 10 characters, maybe 12, somewhere in there. A couple of different arenas. It was fairly straightforward. Good game, but it wasn't very deep. Then they came out with Mortal Kombat Deception. Now, Mortal Kombat Deception, in my mind, was just one of these diamonds that almost everybody missed. Because it had a lot of unlockables, and it had, you know, a lot of modes, and it had a good number of characters. And it had a little, like, even though it had, like, arcade modes, there was a little story mode that was pretty cheesy. But, you know, it still added some depth to the game. So I was a big fan of Deception. But again, it flew under most people's radar. So now they've come out with Mortal Kombat Armageddon, the third installment for their console series. And Armageddon, basically, the concept of Armageddon is, well, we've got Mortal Kombat. Let's just do Mortal Kombat Blick-a-Blam style. So it has not 10, not 12. It's got 60 characters from 60? All the Mortal Kombat games.
60 or 16?
It's like 65. Like 6-5.
Oh my god.
It is ridiculous.
Wow.
So, they have, you know, Liu Kang, zombie Liu Kang, you know, every single possible configuration of characters. Like Cabal. You remember Cabal from Mortal Kombat 3? No, because nobody does, but he's in there. So it brings back a lot of your old favorites. Also, they've recreated a lot of the old levels from Mortal Kombat's like 1 through 3. So like there's subway level in Mortal Kombat 3 where you could knock, you know, it was like in a subway station. Well, now you can knock the guy up over by the subway train and the train runs over him. Awesome. I love it. So there's lots of blood, lots of gore. The gameplay is not really the deepest it could be, but I don't really think it's supposed to be. You're supposed to just punch dude and blood comes out. That's what I like. All right. So there's, you know.
I've always loved that about that series, too. Because Street Fighter and, you know, Soul Calibur, it's all about learning these intricate, you know, stances and combinations. And Street Fighter has all this competitive gaming. No, Mortal Kombat, punch, blood, guts, rip spine out, done.
Well, that's like all moves, every single move in this game is pretty much like one direction, another direction, and a button. So like up, down, triangle, and that's a move. That's pretty much all the moves in the entire game. They're about, you know, maybe 30 per character. And so there's two different fighting styles for each character. You've got a regular style, punch, and then a special fighting style, which is cut. So each character has like a weapon or some sort of like, you know, like the robots. Sektor and Cyrax have these cool like lightsaber blades and stuff, and I didn't write anything down, so I'm trying to do this as I come up with. We prepare so well on the show. I was hoping we were going to skip this.
What is this prepare you speak of?
So, not only is there the arcade mode, but they've added on a bunch of different modes. Like I said, they've upgraded the conquest mode, which was sort of like the adventure mode in the last game, and it's actually not now. So, you can actually play it and not slap your face and go, oh my god, this is the most terrible thing ever. It's actually halfway decent.
Nice.
They've also added Some other games like Motor Combat, which is Mortal Kombat kart racing. That's right. And so, and they've also got a lot of unlockables, but in a way I'm a little disappointed with the unlockables because there's a whole lot of them. I think there are 255 different unlockables from like concept art to music to movies and stuff. But they've moved a lot of the old content from the game onto the second DVD of the premium edition. So like in the original, there was a bunch of cool movies that I like watching. They have these little cards for every character in the game that kind of flip over and they show you like not only the characters that they are working on them now, but you can at least see like as they were filming Scorpion for Mortal Kombat 3 on the blue screen. How awesome is that?
Oh, cool.
And they have, I think they have almost all characters have one of these cards, but in this edition of the game, it's now on the bonus DVD rather than the actual game itself. So a little bit lame. A little bit lame, guys.
So if you get the jank version, can you not unlock those? Is that how that works?
You cannot. You cannot, because it's on a separate disc.
Lame.
And not only that, the Ultra Edition is only on PlayStation 2. And I kind of like the Xbox, but I had to get the PS2 for the Blicka disc. So, okay, we got to talk about fatalities before we move on. So, in the original game, fatalities were these huge button strings you would put in to do some ridiculous move where you turn into a dragon and bite their face off. But now they've got 60 characters.
Like we had flashcards to remember the fatalities. That's how complicated they were.
Yeah. Yeah, since they've got 60 characters now, trying to come up with two fatalities for 60 characters would just be ridiculous. So now they have a create a fatality system, spelled with a K, of course. And that's where, essentially, when you beat an opponent, they kind of stand there, and you put in button presses to do, like, different parts of a fatality. Like, say, for instance, you can rip their ear off, or rip their arm off, or punch them in the nuts, or knock them on the floor. And then you finish it with an ender button, which is the circle button, and then you do something like stomp their face, rip out their spine, you know, crush their head, something like that. And so it gives you a lot more variety and options of what to do, but at the same time, it's not as cool as, like, turning into a dragon and biting their face off like you could in the original games. They all feel a little generic now.
So this
now,
is
the
kind
fatalities.
Of like improvise a fatality is how that works.
Yeah, essentially they want you to make your own fatality, but at the same time they all feel kind of generic. There's no more like, you know, Sub-Zero can no longer freeze you and then blow you into frozen meaty chunks. You know, you can't do that anymore. So it's kind of better in a way, kind of not in a way, but it's still a lot of fun. The overall judgment for Mortal Kombat
still in there for some characters or do
no
characters
they are not
fatalities? Oh my goodness,
no, they're all
I don't
just
know how
the
I feel
generic
about that.
So yeah, it's kind of better, kind of worse, and I see why they did it just because there are so many characters, but I'd still like to see some of those custom fatalities, but oh well. Overall, if you played Deception, this is not a huge upgrade over Deception, so I would maybe wait for it to drop in price. But if you've missed out on the current gen Mortal Kombat series, this is a great place to start. So thumbs up, blick a blam, right there.
All right, dude. Good deal.
All right, now speaking of Mortal Kombat, actually, I'm gonna go into a stump on you guys, impromptu stump.
Ooh.
It's Mortal Kombat Mythologies Sub-Zero.
Yes.
Oh,
I
remember
this
that
game.
That was on on N64, wasn't it?
That it was.
And it was a it was a 3D like platformer thing.
Yeah,
it was like kind of a 3D platformer, kind of a fighting game, kind of a cross between the two. Like I remember it was all in 2D, but I think it turned around and stuff. But I only remember the first level because it was so horrible. Like you are Sub-Zero, and you know you sort of went through like a fighting game. And, you know, it's just like beating a bunch of guys in succession, walking through this level, kind of like Double Dragon style. And just the controls were so horrible that, like, it was impossible to play for me. I don't know if you guys did this too or if I just suck, but, like, you would try to, like, inch forward because there were, like, pillars in the first level that would come down and smash you into chunks. But you couldn't, like, edge forward and jump through. You'd always either jump through into the pillar, or you would edge through and get smashed anyway. Like, it was so horrible.
Well, that's one of the things I liked about the Armageddon. Like, they talk about that a lot on the bonus DVD where they have all this, you know, backstory for each character. Like, one of the character, there's some throwaway character that, you know, Sub-Zero talks to, like, once in Mortal Kombat Mythologies that later became a main character in the console games.
Huh.
And so it's cool to see how they talk about that. Or, like, in Mortal Kombat 3, there is some way you could break the game and, you know, screw it up, and it would say Ermac, like, by somewhere on the screen. And people thought, oh, that's a secret character, and it really meant Error Macro, but they like to take, these rumors and stuff that people like had and then incorporate them into the game, so they made a character later who was called Ermac.
That's pretty cool.
So that was my favorite thing from Deception, and it's still my favorite thing from this game, but it's on the bonus disc now. But it's still really cool though, so check it out.
So, in lieu of our regular discussion section that we do on the show each week, we have a very special guest here to talk to us today about women in games. Not only women playing games, but also women developing games. Brenda Brathwaite is my professor at the Savannah College of Art and Design for Intro to Game Development, and is also chair of the International Game Developers Sex Special Interest Group, and has been a game designer for over 24 years. Thanks for being with us today, Brenda.
Thanks.
So, first of all, tell us a little bit about your experience in the industry and how you got in it in the first place.
Well, I've been in the industry for a really long time, like you mentioned. I started in the industry, believe it or not, when I was 15 in 82. And there really wasn't an industry per se back then. I mean, it was more accidental than industry. And I got into the industry, I guess, if I wanted to just tell the professional highbrow version, I'd say it was networking. But the real story is this other person who also worked there desperately wanted somebody to fill in for her job, and she was looking for a cigarette. And I happened to have one that everybody else was offering menthol, and I had a non-menthol. So she was polite and struck up a conversation with me. And, you know, mind you, we're talking to 15-year-old kids here, so it's not exactly the prettiest scene. But she asked me if I had a job, and I said no. And had I ever heard of wizardry? And at the time, I hadn't. Had I heard of Surtek? And no, I hadn't heard of that either. But did I like games? And the answer was yes, and I had heard of Dungeons & Dragons and played it. So she asked if I wanted a job, and that's how I got into the industry, all over a cigarette.
Wow. So you worked on the Wizardry series and Jagged Alliance and what else? A lot of titles under your belt.
Yeah, well, the whole Wizardry series, so that's 8 of them. And then there's, I think, 3 or 4 Jagged Alliance and... let's see, I've done a Dungeons & Dragons title, you know, a bunch of other smaller titles. Did the Playboy title, and I just finished working on unannounced 360 product for a major publisher.
Oh, an unannounced 360 product. Yeah. So your most recent game you can't talk about on the show, obviously.
No, but I can't.
So as a woman... In the game development industry, how many women are there, first of all?
Well, you know, in the very early days, there were very few. I mean, I could count all the female game designers easily on 2 hands. Easy. Yeah, and maybe even on 1 hand. But now, you know, I'll go to GDC, the Game Developers Conference, and while there's not a waiting line at the women's bathroom yet... I will regularly see women that I don't know when, you know, the women in games roundtable gets together. And I, you know, I don't know everybody at the table, and that's kind of refreshing. There are a lot of women in games now, a whole lot of women in games. It's not the boys club that it used to be. And diversity obviously is good. You know, the more diverse the people making the games, the more people we will appeal to in buying the games.
So, did you find it difficult to progress through the ranks in the game development industry because of your sex, or was it easier? Or,
well, you know, no, I didn't find it more difficult at all. You know, and I've heard some stories from women who have, you know, and there have been some funky things like this. You know, one place I worked, I remember coming into, and there was a, you know, picture of Jenna Jameson on the wall. Which, given my specialty, doesn't freak me out, but clearly might freak some other women out. But I haven't had any difficulty with it. If anything, it has been helpful to me. Like, for instance, I'm doing this interview because I'm a woman in games, and I've been in games a long time. And I've done, I don't know, easily 50 interviews just because I'm a woman making games. So if anything, it's given me a certain amount of notoriety.
Hmm. So you are now a lead designer on major titles.
Mm-hmm.
What does that entail? For those of us who don't really know how it works, what do you do exactly for a game?
Well, it varies game to game, but I guess the lead designer, depending on the size of the project, is responsible for the overall creative vision of the game. You know, so what is this? You know, it's that staring at a blank screen. What is this game going to be about? Defining all the systems, you know, the people, the world, the levels, whatever needs to be defined depending on the genre. And then working with your design team and other leads, you know, the producer, the programmer, the lead artist, to make sure that that vision is carried out. And, you know, it's obviously the vision isn't just held by the lead designer on any project. The whole team is heavily influential in it. But it's making sure that that design, particularly when you're talking like a 360 title that's big and has a lot of systems, there's a lot of little details. You may have 6 or 7 senior designers working on a project, and you know who knows how many junior designers under them. So the lead designer is really making sure that all those details and all those systems are meshing together, and that overall the game that comes out is very close to that original vision, or better than, hopefully, that original vision.
Hmm. So, here's
a quick question. Do you find yourself dipping into programming at all? Because I know from what I've seen, programmers, for the most part, just want to be told what to do, and they don't usually catch those little details that like the designers want to put in. Do you or junior designers have to dip into code at all to kind of like give it that final look and feel, or... or is it truly a creative side, right brain kind of side of development?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I have like 7 answers, I think, for the same question. It's weird. I find that nowadays, you know, toward the end of a project, a lot of the code will be exposed so that there are variables that the designers can go in and change and tweak to make sure the game is balanced just right. But the nature of... the level of professionalism that's required of the code, especially on the next gen products, is so high that, you know, I wouldn't want a junior designer in there messing with the code, or a senior designer, or a lead designer. I just wouldn't want that. That would be a very scary thing, I'm sure, to all involved. The third answer to that question, maybe it's not 7, maybe it's just 3, is that I don't program. And as a lead designer, as a game designer, I consider that a huge handicap. Because I can have an idea in my head, but I can't prototype it. It's like being an artist and you're stuck with your hands in your pocket, and you can just, you know, think about it all you want, but you're not going anywhere with the idea. And so, you know, one of the things that I'm looking forward to doing within the next couple of years is learning how to program so that I can, you know, make at least, you know, it might be an ugly prototype, but that's okay. At least I can see that, you know, the system I'm thinking of in my head works.
Hmm. So what would you say to an art school student like me or any of my other peers who are trying to be a designer like you are, who can't get that kind of training necessarily to the point where they can prototype what they want to see?
Well, it, you know, it depends on what art school you're in. A lot of art schools do offer programming courses, and I think it's important, even if you don't want to be a designer, but you want to enter the video game industry, I think it's important to understand each of the disciplines, if even just a little, to be able to understand the constraints that programmers are operating under, and to be able to understand what it is your fellow artists are trying to do, even if they're animators or, you know, maybe if their job is, you know, just rigging or just texturing, which is certainly happening on some of the, you know, many of the big titles out there have that kind of specialty. I think it's important to make yourself, to avail yourself of that. And if you're a designer, wow, if you're hoping to be a designer ultimately, I can't imagine how that kind of knowledge wouldn't be beneficial for you. You may have, most of the colleges now that I'm aware of do offer that kind of well-rounded experience. They might not have you know, tons of code classes, but you know, like the college that I teach at has, that I'm aware of, at least two C classes, and I think those would be excellent resources or excellent classes to take.
So, on a sort of unrelated question, what is your design process like when you, when you're given, first of all, what are you given in the beginning of a project, and how does that then turn into a game at the end?
Well, it depends on the game. You know, if I'm a lead designer on a project, I'm very much a method designer, and I stole that term from Brando, obviously. I'm certainly no Brando of a designer, but the term works well for me. I have to absolutely learn everything there is that I can possibly learn about the topic. So, for instance, if I were designing a game about the mob, I will watch mob-related movies, mob TV shows, read mob books, mob articles. You know, and in fact, at one point I was working on a game about the mob, and it was ridiculous. I felt like that was all I did. I just immersed myself in that. You know, and obviously you can't go to the PhD level with it, because at some point you have to write that proposal up. But in the amount, during that research time, I just am, you know, surrounding myself in that material. Now with Playboy, to give you an example, now literally 5 feet away from me are easily 600 Playboy magazines.
That's Playboy the mansion for our audience out there.
Yeah. Easily 600 Playboy magazines. I have just tons of Playboy source material. I interviewed Playmates, you know, people at Playboy, you know, all kinds of stuff. The people on the team fairly regularly actually met with Hugh Hefner, who had input on the game, and, you know, it was just great to work with. And so finding out everything there is to know about that, really, who is this man? You know, what is his empire? What do players want to see out of the game? So really immersing myself in that. Then figuring out, depending on the game, what type of systems it's going to need. And then going toward prototype. Now, in the previous games that I've done, none of it's been agile development. So it's been writing out this very long design doc, and, you know, going into production as parts of it are finished. I favor agile development now. I think it makes better games. The people that I know who are currently working in agile development are really enjoying it and are really enjoying the process. So I think, you know, on my next project, you know, hopefully it will be an agile title, and, you know, I may have a totally different answer then. But the nutshell is I surround myself in whatever it is I'm making a game about, find the really interesting and fun things about that, and then try and then think about what is the player going to want out of this game and figure out a way to give the player that experience.
Now it sounds like a really cool gig. What advice would you have for, you know, the aforementioned students that are now looking at a job in game design, since design and programming are so separate now, and, like, say if you were hiring someone, what would you be looking for?
Well, the advice that I'd give to someone who really wants to get into game design is twofold. You know, bearing in mind that there are, it seems like, 100,000 people who wake up every morning in the United States and decide they want to get into game design. When the companies that I've worked for, when they've had, they've just listed an opening for a junior designer, literally thousands of resumes come in, thousands. That's the job that people want. They don't necessarily have to have, you know, they don't have to know how to program. They don't have to know how to draw. And so, you know, anybody can make a game, right? Or so that's the thought sometimes. So the advice that I give is twofold. First of all, you know, get yourself educated. Get yourself educated. You know, that puts you definitely toward the top of that thousand pile. Then if you really want to break in as a game designer, look for companies that are geographically isolated and aren't getting, you know, a zillion resumes. Many people who think they're going to walk out of, you know, walk off the street and get a job as a lead designer at Blizzard, you know, unless they're walking off the street from another lead design gig in the industry, are probably going to have a very difficult time getting that job. But if you look for a company that doesn't necessarily, you know, isn't in a place where a zillion people are going to go, that's a good place to start. Now I forgot the second half of your question. That'll teach me to talk so long.
If you were to hire or interview for a designer position, What would you be looking for in that applicant?
Being well-rounded, so having some programming ability, having or an understanding of programming, and this is assuming a new hire, obviously, if they had some experience in the industry, that would change the answers to all these questions. I'd also be looking for a deep love and a passion for games. Experience having designed something before, whether that is a mod or, you know, even a level on paper is, you know, bearing in mind, you're talking like a pile of 1,000 resumes. Two junior designers that I was part of the hiring process for that we did hire straight out of college, both were absurdly smart. One had a 4.0 GPA, one had a 3.95 GPA, you know, and was very vocal to point out what that 0.5, how that 0.5 was missing. and one of them had just what I thought was the greatest interview answer. You know, I asked him why he wanted to be a game designer, and he said, because my brain is going to do it anyway, and I might as well get paid for it. And these two people had, you know, eventually went on. They had designed board games before, actually did publish a board game, won an award for a board game that they have done. Another one is publishing a combination, I don't know, it's kind of a card game currently. You know, and that's how they broke into the industry. And they impressed me with, you know, first of all, their academic background was really solid. Their love of games was solid. Their understanding of game mechanics was solid. And that impressed me. And that if I said, you know, if I said something about games, I could have a conversation with them where I, oh, and I should have this, where I find a lot of people fall down, and I've seen this happen in interviews, is that they come into the job or they come into the interview hoping to break into an industry, and they haven't done the research at all. So if I said something like, you know, that hot coffee controversy was really pretty crazy last year, you know, what hot coffee controversy? Or I've seen programmers come into interviews and somebody has mentioned, you know, so they'll mention John Carmack and they'll say they're not familiar with who John Carmack is. So that's like walking into, you know, an interview to be a nurse and not know who the AMA is. You know, you want to come to work at a hospital, but you don't know who the AMA is. You know, and so people aren't putting in that time, and it's not a ton of time that's needed just to learn the industry.
So, talking about getting hired for you're talking about a lot of new people coming into the industry. Why, in your words, isn't the gaming industry on the radar for women? Why isn't that a career that many women strive for, or is it now?
Well, you know, if my classes are any indication, there's certainly, you know, maybe if I have a class of 20, there are a couple women in it, which is, you know, 10% certainly higher than it used to be years ago. And, you know, and I do have some classes that are almost evenly balanced, believe it or not. I think it's not on the radar. Well, there's a lot of different reasons, really. That girls, in people like Sherry Grainer Ray, who wrote a book called Gender Inclusive Game Design, she and others who have women in, who have founded Women in Games International, are really looking into this matter. Like, what can they do to bring more women into the industry? It may sound like a completely bizarre change of topic, but I like a 66 GTO, and the reason I like that is because a guy friend of mine drove me in one when I was a young kid. And so somebody introduced me to that. So it's a question of women in the game industry introducing other women women to the potential of a job in the game industry. I think in some respects that it is not taken seriously yet as a real career. And perhaps that's some of the issue. Like my daughter, who's, mind you, only 5, you know, has announced that she wants to be a game designer when she grows up. And some people think this, you know, like she might as well just say she wants to be a rock star or something crazy like that, that people don't necessarily see it as a real path. And I can see, you know, clearly some parents are out there and think like, you know, their kid spends all this time playing games and now he wants to grow up and make them. What kind of, you know, this is crazy. Well, you know, I know people who are landing, you know, nice 5-figure salaries coming out of college in the games industry. So it'll take some time before it gains, I guess, a broader acceptance. And there are a lot of people now talking to, bringing the message directly to women. In fact, here in Savannah, coming up in the spring, we're going to be holding something that is specifically designed to bring that word to women in the industry. And there's a lot of initiatives that are getting underway with women who are already in the industry to talk to women who hope to enter the industry.
So is it the developer's responsibility, or is it the producer's responsibility, or the publisher's responsibility to make games more accessible to women?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, really. You know, I mentioned early on, that diversity is good for us all. And if you have, you know, just a group of guys continuously making games for a group of guys, our market's not going to expand. You look at a game like The Sims, there are lots of women on The Sims team. And, you know, it's not a surprise that The Sims continues to appeal to women. And women actually, one of the things that people think is that women don't play games. But a lot of the recent studies show that it's in the high 40% of women do play games. But if you ask them, they won't say, if you say, you know, are you a gamer? Well, you know, like if somebody says to me, am I a gamer? I don't even like that term. You know, and clearly I'm like pretty hardcore when it comes to playing games, but I don't think of myself as a gamer because for some bizarre reason, there's like a there's just this weird stigma. I don't know what it is, but attached to that word. No, I'm a game player. I play games. Many women will play online casual games. You know, they'll go play Diner Dash or, you know, Minesweeper, or they'll play like internet, you know, chess or something like that. But are they gamers? No. But are they playing games? Yes. So women do play a lot more games. We have there was a Women in Games conference that I went to a couple years back, and they were talking about the way we advertise games. You know, definitely appeals to men. The magazines do. That the advertise well from the advertising to the media. You know, to the characters in games. They're just much more, you know, it's designed for that core market. If you can appeal to this, you know, teen male demographic or young adult male demographic. And people clearly do that. But women, gosh, there are many people who are much more knowledgeable about this and who have studied this than me. But, you know, women, the way they like to shop, like, there are some stores, like the stores that traditionally sell games, I go in and they feel so crowded and I just don't like it and I feel overrun with people. Or people not understanding what games women might want to play. I've had an experience at three stores running. I was trying to find a particular game. And when I went into this, it's a chain store here where I live. And when I went into the store and I asked them if they had this game and they said, what console? And I said, I don't care because I don't. I own them all. And so the guy said to me in one store, you know, well, which console do your kids have, ma'am? You know, in another store, well, do you know what console your kids have? I don't remember how they said it, but in all of them, it was assumed that I wasn't the player. If I go into a store and ask, and I did this just as a test once when I was researching an article, and I would go into a store and say, do you have a game, you know, a game, you know, I'm interested in getting a new game. Can you suggest something? And so one guy said, how old are your kids? Another one directed me to something just utterly silly, but very stereotypical. You know, so it's people not also understanding what games women like to play. It's amused me how much my students, at least this year, the women seem to be into GTA.
Right.
You know, hardcore GTA players and, you know, so it's really an interesting thing. And there's a lot of people who are looking at different ways. How can they reach women who are interested in purchasing games? Something to think about, too. Like if you go, you know, go to the grocery store and, you know, pull Cosmo and Women's Day and those magazines off the shelf, you're not going to see a gaming column in those magazines. But if you go pull men's magazines, like if you pull Playboy off the shelf, you will find a gaming column in Playboy. So if women aren't reading about it, you know, if there's not a column saying, hey, here's some great games on the shelf this month that you might want to check out, well, you know, the news isn't getting to them. So it really just hasn't come to the forefront of women's conscious yet. But I think that's going to change. I really believe it's like a 10-year problem. And as younger women become older women, those articles will start to appear.
And you mentioned that a lot of your, like, female students are into hardcore GTA. I remember I noticed something similar back in a game design contest that I was that I entered into. I noticed that my game had like the highest percentage of female gamers, but it's this hardcore shooter, blood and guts flying everywhere, a game that you would think women would not be into, but yet it had the highest percentage. So my question is, I guess, to like, do women gamers need to be catered to, or, you know, is it more just like, just give them the, you know, the full bloody, gory, you know, blood and guts GTA car stealing scene and just be true to your art and they'll be into it? Or what is your opinion on that?
Well, there's an awesome book. I think I would defer my opinion to this. A lot of which is formed by this book called Gender Inclusive Game Design, which was written by Sherry Grainer Ray, a colleague of mine. And it's not so much, her basic point is, it's not so much that women don't like games or that women aren't into games or aren't, you know, don't want to play games. It's that we do things as developers or as publishers or as marketers that drive women away. You know, for instance, you know, consider the hypersexualized female avatars in video games. Sherry gives this talk in which she shows at some point during her presentations these two hypersexualized males. And you can just see every man in the room flinch.
She did this in our class.
I did, and it was hysterical. And, you know, you can just tell the guys were like, please change that slide, but I wouldn't. And then I, in fact, went back to it several times just because it was so funny. I mean, there's nothing nasty is being shown. I mean, it really is. Like, it's an academic thing. I don't want people to be alarmed about, you know, geez, what the heck is she showing people? But it's just these men who are really good looking, you know, and they don't look like, they're not in like, you know, an Arnold Schwarzenegger sort of, I'm a tough guy kind of pose, you know, the male hero pose. In that women in games, like, you think, would you want to go running around a game watching, if you were a woman and you had not played games before and you suddenly load up your avatar and, you know, her shirt is, you know, cut down to her waist and she's wearing a thong to go off into the dungeon. Like, what's up with that? You know, it just looks, if you are a woman and you've never played games before, that just looks stupid and offensive. In even worse, if you imagine, like, you know, your son, let's say you have a 13-year-old son and he picks up a game and it's like that, what kind of meaning are you going to give to this game? You're just going to think, my God, these games are stupid, you know, and maybe not even want to play any of them yourself, you know, and so you give titles like The Sims a wash or Katamari Damacy or, you know, any of the, like Fahrenheit, which I've been playing recently, there's a lot of good games, or Psychonauts, you know, I mean, I have this whole massive pile of games I've been trying to get through. So we do things, though, that deliberately push women away. There was a box cover, in fact, in which the breasts were embossed. Women who play first-person shooters frequently report that it's uncomfortable. It's not a comfortable play experience for them because people will say, like, oh, man, I totally raped you. You know, and now maybe it's a term that, you know, guys say to guys, but you know, if you're online and you're hearing that sort of stuff, it's like, come on, you know, there are so many verbs. Can you find another one that's not like that one? And so, you know, women don't appreciate that kind of stuff. So it's as developers, my gosh, there's so many things, like the different learning styles, the way we do tutorials is much more geared toward male learning than female learning, the way games are displayed in stores. There's all kinds of stuff. You know, to anybody who's really interested in the subject, I would heartily recommend Sherry's book. And again, it's called Gender Inclusive Game Design.
So this question just occurred to me. Have you ever tried to draw analogy from an industry that has similar sort of experiences with this? For instance, like the comic book industry features hypersexualized women and the same sort of characterizations that we see in games. And I don't think they've attracted many more women now than they have, you know, 50 years ago. Is there any way that games are going to the gaming industry is going to prevent that from happening to them?
Well, I mean, games cost a lot more money to make than comics, you know? Like, you can do a print run of comics and, you know, and of course, probably there will be several emails that'll follow this saying, she's crazy, it costs a lot of money to make comics, too. You know what I do? Actually, I have a friend who's a sequential artist and, you know, has done several novels, so I'm sure I'll get something from him saying I'm totally making that up. But if we want to expand our market, we can't. We can't do that. We can't say, oh, well, I guess women don't want to play games, because the all of the facts point to the fact that, yes, they do want to play games. They're online now. If you go to, like, to Yahoo Casual Games, and it'll say, like, there's some absurd number of people playing online. Man, I'd love a portion of that. And women do. Women love, like, if you look at, like, Second Life, almost half their community is women. Almost half of it is women. Women really are enjoying online, you know, the MMOs. And so, take a look at MySpace. It's not that women are afraid of computers or they don't want to do that sort of stuff. Women are playing games. It's just making our games in such a way that they don't offend women, that they don't push them away. I mean, there are some games that have, you know, some comedic bits in it that I know women just find horrific. You know, like, that's just so not funny. So, I'm not positive that I answered your question there, but.
So you're saying that the gaming industry would greatly benefit from sort of changing our games, changing the way that we're representing people and things like that, to cater more to the female audience?
Well, to at least allow women a choice. You know, some games, if they have avatars and they're going to put them in plate mail thong bikinis as they head out into the dungeon, you know, at least give an option for the female player to cover that butt up if they so choose. You know, some games don't have that option. And so, allow, like, what's wrong with one of the things in studying sex games, one of the biggest complaints that I hear are, where are the sex games for women? And, you know, regrettably, my answer is still, well, you know, I don't know. It's alleged there are some in development, but there are still none. There are still none, unless you count something like strip poker and it's a guy who gets naked. but no, there are still no sex games for women at this point in time.
So you wrote a book on this subject, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It's called Sex and Video Games, and it was just released last month, in fact. And it covers pretty much everything there is. Everything that I knew about sex and games is in that book. From the history of sex and games to, you know, what's obscenity, to censorship, to self-regulation, to the whole hot coffee scandal that happened with Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. To interviews with some, you know, great people in the industry who were kind enough to give me interviews, like, you know, Bob Bates, who was head of the IGDA recently. I mean, he's no longer the head of the IGDA, but was the head of the IGDA. And Richard Garriott, who was Lord British, and Steve Moresky, who worked on a lot of, you know, classic adventure games, including Leather Goddesses of Phobos, believe it or not. And there's an interesting point. Leather Goddesses of Phobos, you know, people wonder, like, well, geez, well, how aren't games friendly to women? Well, it wasn't until Steve's game in 1987, mind you, which, of course, you know, may seem like eons ago to many people, but the industry was, you know, pretty well rolling along. It wasn't until his game that you could even be a female in a video game. Like, before, you go in and you're just all men. There you are. Have a nice time. Off you go. And his was the first game that allowed players to choose what gender they were going to be.
Didn't we talk about that game on the show, Justin Fick, Leather Goddesses of Phobos? Was that on a stump buck one time?
I don't think so. I want to say it's come up, though. It had to have.
With a title like
knowing the three of us. But similarly, it's funny, because I remember when I was a tadpole and Metroid came out, and we finally beat Metroid. You know, remember Samus finally takes her suit off, and it turns out that Samus is a woman, and it was like this big huge shock to the entire gaming industry. They're like, oh my god, it's like I was a woman that whole time, kicking all this ass, and the main character is not this dude.
But at the same time, though, she takes more clothes off if you beat the game with more secrets. So
true.
And there were some people who were upset about that. Some people were actually upset about that. That, you know, that it was a woman, and they didn't know all this time, and they felt like, you know, there were people who reported feeling violated that they had been playing as this woman. You can't make this stuff up. That actually isn't in my book, but yeah. There are many things about that.
Vic, you have one more question?
So, wanted to switch gears into the teaching. So you're a teacher now, and you teach Mr. William Miller. I mean, give us an overview about that, and how is how much of your time do you spend teaching? Is it a part-time thing, a full-time thing? Are you a guest teacher?
No, I'm actually a full professor. And let's see, I'm teaching 4 classes right now, and it's all game design, game industry. And I also am doing an independent study with 4 students just about game design, you know, the pure art of game design. How do you make a game from that initial idea on through to completed game design doc? So it's, you know, I have what the industry, this industry, the academic industry calls contact time. I have 20 hours of contact time where I'm actually with my students. And then, you know, some ridiculous hour outside of amount of hours outside of that. You know, putting together lectures, researching stuff, playing games, which, hey, I get to still claim as work. But it's an awesome gig. I love it. I mean, I get paid to go in. You know, I've been very fortunate that I got to go in and make games for years. And now I get paid to go in and talk about making games. So I feel like I won this little personal lottery, frankly. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I was concerned that when I left the industry full time that, you know, what, I feel creatively fulfilled. And I absolutely do, because these students have so much energy, so much energy. You know, it's all about they can't wait to make games. And here's this great idea I have. You know, and maybe they're just working on a board game. You'd think, like, how can that possibly be any fun or relate to video games? But it's a lot of the basic mechanics, and it's that ability to create, to build a game out of nothing, or, you know, to modify a game to be something that's your own. And I love it. The hardest part about it for me is that when my students are doing these modifications to games, I can't do it. You know, I can't get in there and go, hey, can you, like, hey, Will, step aside and let me do this. And that's hard. You know, that's hard because I really do want to get in there. Or, you know, if I think students, you know, they might be working on a particular part of a project, and I think, oh, gosh, I wish they'd do this. And you can't necessarily say that. I mean, if I see them going in a direction that I think is just way wrong, obviously it's my job to say, wait, you guys should rethink it. But I really enjoy it. It's awesome. And I feel very creatively fulfilled. And I'm still very in touch with the industry. I'm working on a project now, and I'm just signing on another project to work on it in December. So so I'm still actively involved in both worlds. Did you want more information?
So what is your opinion then? Oh, sorry.
I didn't know if you wanted information specifically on teaching Mr. Will Miller. You wanted specific details on that. I can't say.
His grades, how's he doing?
So far he's doing really well. And he has impressed me with his Guitar Hero skills. Just blew me away, actually, because I was trash talking, as I'm known to do. You know, like, I will just say, like, I'm the greatest in any game, right? And so I'm trash talking, and then I find out the dude actually worked on it, right? And it's like, oh, whoops, maybe I'll shut up now. And so then I bring Guitar Hero in, and I'm thinking, okay, I just hope he's, like, not, you know. I mean, and then I saw him do Bark at the Moon on Expert, and it was like, I'm done. I am finished my trash talking for this quarter. So I have totally, and it really is, if you've not seen somebody play, you know, somebody who can really play Guitar Hero, it was crazy. It was awesome. It was awesome. And then when he was done, he was vibrating just because of all the massive amounts of adrenaline trying to get through the song. Yeah. So that's been the highlight of my class so far. You know, making Will go
me and Mr. Sleep. William Miller are yet to throw down. I'm coming out there.
Justin
Fink
thinks he could beat me.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm telling you, it was pretty incredible. It was pretty incredible.
Okay, I think we've lost Blake Buck. We have one more thing that we usually do with our guests. I need to get Blake Buck back on the horn here. And Blake Buck.
Yo.
You with us?
I'm here.
All right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. I think we're all ready for battle, Blake Buck.
Oh, we're ready for battle, you say?
Brenda, we do this with all of our guests on the show, and we ask them 5 questions that they should know the answer to in rapid succession. The best so far has been 3 out of 5. Are you ready?
I'm terrified, but I'm ready.
Okay. Question number one. In Fight Night Round 3, what company provided a good deal of the highly invasive in-game advertisement as well
Burger
as an
King.
Unlockable character? Yes, that is correct. Blake Buck's favorite, Burger King. In the original Wizardry, where did the names Werdna and Tredbor come from?
Andrew Greenberg and Robert Woodhead. It's their first name backwards.
That is correct. Those are the two main programmers. In Sierra's 1981 text-based game Soft Porn Adventure, which we've talked about on the show before, who is the famous female game designer lounging in a hot tub on the game's cover?
That would be Ms. Roberta Williams, and she's seated to the right.
That is correct.
Even got the position on the box.
Oh, man, that's good.
Who do we think we were screwing with?
I don't know. How many Jagged Alliance games are there?
Oh, Lord have mercy. I worked on this. You'd think I'd know. I'm going to guess and say 5.
There are 8.
Damn it.
There's the most recent incarnation is Jagged Alliance 2. Yep. That's the buzzer. Most recent Jagged Alliance 2 is being ported to the DS.
Really?
It was released in 2005, yes. Okay.
There you go.
Final question, and this is somewhat of a self-serving question. In Playboy the Mansion, how do we unlock the breast enlargement slider?
Oh my gosh, you know, I don't know that. I don't know it. It's my own game. I was in crunch.
Well, we don't know either. We were hoping you could tell us.
Wait a minute. Wait. I know how to do it.
Oh.
You get points, and you spend your points, and you can buy anything you want with those points. So if you save enough points at the end of a mission, you can unlock it.
Oh, all right. Well, that's 4 out of 5. That's pretty good.
She
so
got
far.
The trick question all
right.
even.
Oh, man, that's intense.
Well played.
Well played.
That was panic.
Excellent work.
Well, Brenda, thank you very much for being on the show, and we sure appreciate you taking your time out of your evening here to come on the show
thank
and talk
you.
To us.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
All right, well, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks
thank
a lot.
You very much. All right, let's wrap this up. I'm hungry.
Oh, my goodness, we're going to hell.
You're hungry. Wayne Miller says to me, let's wrap this up. He's hungry. Please. I got hot wings I'm ready to make. Let me ask you guys this. Am I going to eat hot wings or pizza? I've been debating this for about the past hour.
Dude, you have no idea. Crazy Pizza in New York, which is right up the street from Freeverse Software, they have buffalo chicken on pizza. Blam.
Hot wings, chicken, pizza?
It's not wings. There's no bones, but it's like buffalo boneless wings on pizza.
Whoa.
Blam.
Oh, see, here's the debate. Whenever something's going on in my head, it's like a big, UN council, and they're debating the sides, all these ambassadors. And the ambassador from, Buffaloville says, but hot wings taste so much better. And then the other side says, yeah, but they're so much more difficult to make. You gotta, turn them and watch them and stuff. I don't know. Pizza's a lot easier. Yeah, but they're hot wings, man. And then the other guy's like, yeah, but it's not as filling as pizza. And you're like, you're right. What are we going to do? And right now they're all
Dude,
in their
you
ballot
make
boxes.
Both and you put the hot wings on the pizza. Blam.
I'm going to do it. I swear to God. Yep. I'm going to do
Double
that and take pictures of it. That's what I'm doing tonight. All right. So that does it for this week of the best damn podcast ever. What do you guys think about that?
Dude,
I'm hungry.
That power is strong.
It's strong also- power.
We'd like to thank our guest Brenda for stopping by, chatting with us. That was good to hear from a different side of the gaming industry.
A different side of the gaming industry?
I'm trying to get you guys to say something.
What
you
the hell
so
are
stupid.
You talking about?
I hate you. Oh, my hot wings! Oh, my hot wings!
Oh. Okay, those listeners that were complaining about not seeing the show spiral into oblivion.
This is going out as is. No edits. Okay. 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 If you would like to produce content for our lovely websites that we're so professional about updating, we're accepting applications for writers. Just send us an email at feedback at bestsampodcastever.com. What happened?
You were going to say feedback at podcast at insidemaggames.com.
That's what I was going to say. That is what I was going to say. Yeah, so we need writers, guys. We need people who could do... If you can help the website in any way, if you know PHP, if you know...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Let me
yeah, you do this.
Shout out for that.
I've fallen to pieces here.
We need people who have talent and are funny.
Okay, look. We're trying to... we've got some pretty nifty ideas for this website, and they involve some proprietary heat. So if any of you guys are proficient, now I'm not talking about like I read a book once and think I know this, so I'm going to help you guys. No.
Or I have a website. Like, check out helloworld.html.
Yeah, we don't want that. We want like...
See, because I read a book once on PHP.
Yeah, so we don't want Justin
Fick. If you are that, I can do better than you.
We want power PHP coders. One of them that's really good. Who can work for free to help us realize this dream of ours. But,
oh, wow.
Yeah,
I like how you just took, like, pay for no work, but made it sound noble. Wait a minute. I got that backwards.
Oh, it's all for you guys. It's all for the listeners. So, we have some really neat ideas about how to make the site more interactive for everybody and sort of consolidate all that power. And if you'd like to write for the site or contribute video content or audio content to the site, you know, the key thing
is just be funny. That's like you saw, not really just be funny, just say something unusual. We don't want the same kind of stuff that every other game site does. You saw Mike Watson's article. He talked about how he hated Final Fantasy VII, and it was both unusual and funny. And that's good stuff. That's what we want to have more of on the site. Not
and have a picture of a toilet in Final Fantasy.
Not I reviewed Blam. Marathon. You know who you are. wait a minute, I shouldn't make fun of the help. Don't make fun of the help.
That just about does it for this week in gaming. Thanks to all you guys for listening. Blake Buck is incapacitated because of his need for hot wings. So we'll see you on the show next week, and thanks for tuning in.
I'm Blake Buck.
I'm William Miller.
And I'm Boss Hogs.
And we'll see you next time.
I don't understand what's going on here.